Hi, Rachel Hands. This is our second part of our conversation.
Hey, Bill.
Yes. Rachel is a great teacher at Glencoe Elementary School. Last week, we talked about the difficulties of teaching these classes full of kids with different skills, different levels of development, all of them needy, of course, at age 7. Rachel spends more time per day with them than their parents by a long shot, without any help, and having to deal sometimes with really difficult problems and kids, and meet the school's requirement that these kids all come out with higher math scores than the kids in Japan and Singapore and other places, not to mention everything else that corporate America thinks is important for teaching our children. Rachel tries to help people think and live together and respect one another, as well as do sufficiently well on reading tests. And in fact, you probably, Rachel, do better. Your kids are going to do better because they aren't being standardized and forced into all of this sort of meaningless learning, because you sort of embed the things, learning skills and problem-solving skills, in your curriculum.
Well, there's no way to know that, and I've put very little stock in standardized testing. So the thing that's valuable to me is when I have kids in middle school come back and say they remember certain projects or units that we did that they still have the artifacts from in their house, and that's much more meaningful to me.
That must be wonderful, having the kids come back, that you could have a relationship like that.
I'm not going to say it happens all the time.
Well, I bet you must see kids on the street, too, remember, right?
Yeah.
A good teacher also is so important. Let's talk about your teaching and as you pointed out, the amazing teaching that's happening across this city, even in the schools defined as failing schools, schools.
I've worked at a quote-unquote failing school, and it was an amazing place with a lot of teachers going above and beyond daily and an amazing community. I mean, that's the thing. Those tests don't measure anything about family and student engagement and the kind of teaching that's going on. The worst part of that is it creates this label of failure with people who are working so hard, often against incredible odds, and it's a complete disregard and disrespect for the work that they do, both teachers and the students and the families. So a couple things that I know are true is some of the best teachers doing some of the most innovative things are teachers that listen to and respect student voice. So I know that the climate justice work and ethnic studies work all came out of students really fighting for these things, to see this kind of curriculum in their schools, and the teachers that support and encourage those kids fighting for those things. But the kind of stuff that's happening in our building, you've heard of the Black Lives Matter Week of Action that happens in schools throughout the country now. It's built. It started in Seattle, but it has built out to become a national movement, and it happens every year in February. And this year, there was a committee that came out of PAT that really worked to put this on through the schools. But the kind of curriculum that is being shared across from teachers in DC and Philadelphia and Seattle, I mean, it's a network of really great lessons and teaching and artwork and materials to support this week of action. And we did that all over the district, and with support of principals and even the district to some degree. But we were teaching really important lessons about solidarity and empathy and community, but all through a racial justice lens around Black lives really mattering and what that looks like in our schools and in our society. So that's just one thing that's happening around the district. I think the climate justice work also happening around the district to a much smaller degree, just because I don't think there's space and time and institutional support to allow that to happen in every classroom, but that is the goal and the aim of the resolution. But in our own school, I like to teach the storyline method, which is you create questions that you're trying to answer, large-scale questions. The whole unit, it's an interdisciplinary unit, and you create a world that you inhabit. So our whole second grade team at Glencoe does a neighborhood storyline, and we create a neighborhood. It has a name. We talk about what would the most welcoming neighborhood look like, what would be in it, what services would be available to people, and we create this neighborhood, and everyone creates characters that live in the neighborhood and work in the neighborhood. We have city council elections. And then we have a series of events or incidents that happen, and the community comes together to decide how to deal with it. So one of the things that my brilliant colleague thought of was to have a oil company offer jobs and money for them to have us allow them to put an oil pipeline through our community. And then we learn about what impact that would have, and we learn about fossil fuel extraction and all the leaks that have happened and what that does to the environment, and a bit about global warming and how what we can do to stop it and transition to renewable energy. So this is second grade, and they love this, and they are just hungry to learn about all these things and apply it to...
And apply it. I mean, yeah. You could teach math in a variety of ways, right? Like just temperature and...
You know, I've never had a class that had kids voting to have the oil pipeline go through our neighborhood. But then we talk about, if not us, who? So we talk about what it means to divert from one community and have it impact another community. So then we start thinking about kind of our responsibility to fight something so that it doesn't impact any of us, not just us. And we also always, every year, have a family move to our community from another country, and usually it's based on something that's happening in the news. So it's been family from the Marshall Islands who are climate refugees, family from Syria fleeing from war. You know, we've had one year it was Japan after the tsunami and the nuclear meltdown. So we study that country, and we think about how to welcome them into our neighborhood. And just as an example of how real and meaningful this is for kids, this year when we learned about immigrants and refugees and asylum seekers, and one of the kids came in and said, I think we should do a fundraiser for IRCO, the organization here in town, to raise money to support families that are coming to Portland. And the class raised $300, I think. Kids would bring in spare change. They brought in money from their piggy bank. Parents chipped in, and they got to write letters and send this to a real organization doing real work that they wanted to support. And they have a sense of what it means to recognize other people that have needs that are different from their own, and how to support and welcome everyone in our community. You know, the kind of conversations happening in our school are, we talk about racial justice, we talk about economic justice, we talk about
gender justice.
We have a timeline in our classroom that has things on it, like, you know, when gay marriage was legalized in the country, and when Jim Crow was ended. I mean, we study all kinds of real life, real issues that kids feel very strongly about.
Within that, there's also a process that I'm sure you do that is not you at the front of the room lecturing these kids.
Right.
Right. You're not standing there for 6 hours and 20 minutes with their computers and taking down every word so that they can feed it back to you at the end of the year in the exam. That's not the way you do things. It's group-oriented. It's kids teaching kids. It's very democratic, too, right? Kids have an opportunity to work with others and probably to challenge you, right?
Oh, yeah. For sure.
I hope they do.
They do.
Yeah, do they?
Yeah. We have.
You must love that.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, it's great. We have really wonderful debates. A lot of the conversations that occur are things that are brought up by kids. So it's like a lot of the things that we've explored and learned about have emerged from student voice and student conversation. And there is a great wealth of children's books out there. I think that we're in a kind of a golden age in terms of subject matter and the kind of people that are being represented and struggles that are being represented.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah. So reading a book about a particular person's struggle, Malala, Cesar Chavez, the janitor strike in LA, there are all these like wonderful kids' books out there. And they have questions. Why is it like that? How can they have people working for that little money? How can they use pesticides that make people sick? Why is that legal? Why is that okay? And so a lot of these conversations come from their very real questions and concerns in their own sense of what is fair and what is just. And through that, we explore how things are established legally and through political process, but also how people organize and fight to make things better for their own lives. And that resonates with kids.
How do you deal with the differences between kids and their willingness to stand up and express themselves? I mean, you have some who are really eager to be heard, eager to present. And then you have some kids who are shy and some who are withdrawn and some who have trouble listening. How do you deal with those dilemmas? Some kids could really stand out.
Well, there are a few things. One thing is every morning we start with a morning meeting where we're in a circle and we greet each other by name around the circle so that everyone feels welcome first thing in the morning and seen as a person, as an individual. And so starting from the very beginning of the year, first we share more light, superficial things, your favorite animal, or if you've ever had a pet, if you have a sibling, you know, just get to know you stuff. Mm-hmm. But then as the year goes on and we're talking about bigger and bigger ideas and getting to know each other more, we talk about, you know, what do you do if somebody is being unkind to you, or what do you do if you watch somebody being a bully to someone else? And we talk about real scenarios, real things that they're actually dealing with. And kids always have the opportunity to pass if they want to. So there's no forced conversation. We start every morning with a morning meeting, and every afternoon we end the day with a community circle. There are kids that it takes a long time for them to start to share in community. But eventually, I've always had kids, even the shyest kids, start to share because they feel heard, they feel respected, and like their voice matters. And in that moment, we have a little talking piece. They are the only one that gets to talk. So there's a real respect for each individual getting to share their feelings about a particular subject. And just the other day, I was like, why is community circle important? That was the question. And kids said things like, we get to speak from our heart and know that it's not going to leave the circle, that this is a space for us to share with each other. They say things like, we get to know each other better. We get to develop empathy for each other. I mean, these are 7 and 8 year olds, and the amount of care and respect that they have for each other because we create space for that every single day. And that's how we start and end our day. So I think that is crucial to building class community in my class.
Carries over into the next day then. kids learn how to be democratic, actually, and mm-hmm. how to engage.
Mm-hmm. We actually talked, too, about step forward, step back. If you're a kid that doesn't talk very much, sometimes try to push yourself to speak from your heart. And then kids who like to talk a lot, take a step back and create space for other people. I mean, it's really, really challenging for seven-year-olds not to talk all over each other. I won't say that, that is an easy task, but it's something that we work on every single day. Respect the speaker, be a good listener, listen with your ears, your heart, your whole body, right? It's not just not talking, it's actually listening to the person speaking. And so I try to center every child who speaks is equally deserving of your full focused attention as any teacher that's speaking to you. So that's part of it. And there are kids that they're more introverted, they're more shy. We have small group, we have partner shares. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways that throughout the day we give space for people who prefer a more intimate conversation to the larger group conversation.
Every kid should have the opportunity to be in your class, it sounds to me. But there are a lot of teachers who are doing that. That's the interesting thing. What you're doing now is, my guess is the product of support from a decent administration of the school, support from other teachers. When you entered, there were all sorts of other teachers. You were sort of one of the new people, right? That's how it works in schools, right? Teachers do help teachers.
Oh, yeah.
Support from the union that has fought to give you some room in the classroom and has disciplinary procedures so that a bad principal or vice principal or whoever can't just silence you and get rid of you quickly. You have powers and has fights for teacher capacity to work together.
I also think when you're doing things that you know are right, if you're fighting for what you know is right, which is to put the student first, to center the student and not the test score, to center the kids that are in your class and not some expectation created by somebody who has no idea what you or your students are trying to do every day, then it's easy to do right by your kids if you know what's right. And I think, but you're right. It's like it takes time. It takes time in the system to know how to push back and to know how to fight for your kids. And it's harder when you're a new teacher, I think, to understand that.
Although even if you have good values and know what's right, translating that into pedagogy or curriculum and developing the storyline and knowing when to have kids in a group and when to do it as a whole group, what ideas to introduce. You, after all, are the leader of this. A teacher is a skill, right? I mean, it's a series.
You're all constantly growing and reevaluating and changing. I mean, it's just in some ways an amazing profession. There's no end to the growth that you can make as a professional educator. Everything from restorative justice classes to the storyline class to reading and trying to improve my own practice. Yeah, it's just ongoing.
Rachel Haynes, this has been a revelation, actually. This is very moving. On a daily basis, almost, when a shy kid suddenly begins moving towards feeling better about themselves and being able to speak and express themselves, it must be very fulfilling for you, right? When all of those moments, in fact, there's probably so many moments of the day when you feel, oh God, but there's probably other times when you feel, wow, this is just, it's just wonderful what's happening.
I do think that what we do every day in schools is a pretty wild, crazy social experiment. I mean, we are in a room of, up to 30 individuals who are learning how to move all together, learn all together, do everything all together, which is completely unnatural to spend an entire day as a big unit doing every single thing together and have to learn how to push ourselves or be pushed, and also how to support each other and negotiate like very real conflict and tension, because we don't all have the same needs at the same time. But in that process, a beautiful thing happens. I mean, we develop a community that loves and cares for each other. I mean, every year I cry at the end of the school year, even the hardest class that I maybe am like dying for summer break so I can get some emotional and mental release, because it's been a hard year. I love every one of my students, and I'm sad to see them go. And it just feels like a really strange and special thing that we're doing every teacher does every year. And I mean, that's part of the thing I wish people understood about teaching, is the amount of emotional investment and care and concern for our students every year for so many kids. It's just like, when I really think about it, it feels almost, you know, it feels monumental what teachers give of themselves because they love their students so much. And we get so much back from that. But it's a really big part of the job that I think a lot of people don't understand, is the every year there's a little loss, you know? We have to lose these children that we've invested so much in and we care so much about, and then we set them free.
And you also know all the challenges ahead for them.
Yeah.
Which is all daunting and sort of...
Yeah. I mean, the hardest kids are the kids that are closest to my heart, you know. They're the ones I continue to worry about. They're the ones that I think about for years to come. Teaching is a pretty wild experience, to say the least.
But it's really also wonderful in a lot of ways. You're doing work that's meaningful and that you want to do despite all of the testing and the corporate sort of demands and all of the rest of it. You know, it's a privilege to have work that is, in fact, in some ways so important and fulfilling.
Yeah.
I would think. Rachel Haynes, teacher at Glencoe School. This Monday, you'll be going into your class. Six hours and 20 minutes starts. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Bill.